It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. From the center of our lives, let us make room for the quiet moments of life. We use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. With me in an attitude of prayer, it is the end of another year and time to take stock. Are the gods we are serving worthy of us? Could we be convicted of neglecting or abusing our own souls? Don't let us be called faithless, for we have a kind of faith, and we serve our gods well even when we do not serve wisely. We play our roles. For the most part, we serve characters in the stories of our lives. Yet how often do we examine the scripts we have agreed to play? Now it is the end of another year. Let us pause for a private meeting with our gods before going on to another year. Let us pause not only to ask how faithful we are, how well we are serving the gods whose priorities frame our lives, but also to ask whether these are gods worth serving. Do they call forth the best in us? Does serving the gods of our lives make us more authentic, more of who we need to become to honor our unique spirit, to bring to the world our own best gifts? Or have we become means to someone else's ends, cogs in a machine that drains us rather than enlarging us? For though the world can be a sacred place, we too are sacred. And unless the gods we serve reward that, they are not worthy of us and not worthy of our world. It is the end of another year, a time to pause and take stock of what we are serving with our lives before going on. Let us take stock of our gods. Amen. I think in every tradition, the end of one year and the beginning of the next is a time for introspection, for reviewing the past year, for judging whether we have lived it wisely or foolishly, lived by high standards or low standards. It's a time for us to check in with ourselves, with the story we're living out with our lives, to see if it's a story that is leading toward an ending we would be proud of. If we take this seriously, it can be a very upsetting task, especially when an honest assessment says that we're not doing all that well. It's been said that children want justice, whereas adults plead for mercy. I found in thinking about endings that both yearnings are alive and vivid, both the yearning for justice and the plea for mercy. So I want to put together some odd parts. I want to put together two new movies, a 19th century play, and a very old and very strange parable from Jesus to help focus our thinking on endings. The movies and the play will satisfy the kid parts of you that want judgment and justice. In the parable of Jesus, one of his oddest and most controversial offers a kind of mercy that you may find both surprising and welcome, as I do. Writing endings is tricky. It's not as easy as you might think, because the ending, whether we like it or not, has to grow out of the story, not contradict it. Winston Churchill once famously said, "History will be kind for me, for I intend to write it." In fact, though, history was kind to him, because those who really did write it saw that he had demonstrated eloquence and leadership in the service of character and courage during critical moments in World War II. Churchill didn't have to worry. Still, it's true that at the level of governments and mass media, power often does trump truth. And official stories that were not true ever can last for decades or centuries without being questioned. I'm still amazed that the Warren Commission report of the murder of John Kennedy is taken seriously. One simple reason we can know that it can't be true is because, as many have shown, in order for there to have been only one gunman, the absolutely pristine, unmarked bullet found on Kennedy's stretcher would have to have gone through two bodies and shattered three bones without ever getting a scratch on it, and that isn't possible. Still, it's been over 40 years, and whatever the truth is no closer to coming out than it was then. And a current example, polls, and polls I think are always frightening. Polls are saying that 70% of Americans actually think that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had some connection with the attacks of 9/11, even though there was no connection of any kind. But 70%, that's enough to elect anything. It's depressing. It gives a lot of weight to the cynical revision of Abraham Lincoln's famous saying, the cynical revision which goes, "You can fool all the people some of the time, you can fool some of the people all the time, and that's enough." So I know that no matter how much I wish it weren't true, it seems true that at the level of governments and mass communication, power can trump truth, character, and courage, even for a very long time. But at the personal level, I don't think this happens very often. Here, we really don't fool anywhere near as many people as we think we do. Because in life, there's a kind of judgment at the end. And the reason there's a kind of judgment is because in life, we almost never get to write our own endings. They are written by those who survive us, who have their own ideas about how the story needs to be summed up. Now, this is the computer age and the internet age, and I checked because I suspected this would be true, and regrettably it is true. You can go online and you can buy eulogies. That's kind of amazing if you think about it. For 30 or 40 bucks, they're not cheap, of course. For 30 or 40 bucks, they'll send you three eulogies, and you can mix and match to find the sounds that suit you best. I want to save you some money. Don't bother. Even if you buy them, you can't count on their being read at your memorial service anyway. because those decisions won't be made by you. They'll be made by those who survive you, and they'll have their own ideas. I've been at enough memorial services to believe that the truth usually comes out at the end. If it isn't spoken from the pulpit, first, I think if it isn't spoken from the pulpit, a sin has been committed. But if it isn't spoken from the pulpit, you'll hear it buzzing through the congregation. We want the ending to have an organic relation to the whole life, and most of us have some sense of how that should play. I was reminded of some words from one of my favorite writers in Western history, Michel de Montaigne, from the 16th century, very early 17th. If you've never read his essays, I'd recommend them to you. At one point he said, "If we have not known how to live, it is wrong to teach us how to die and to give the end a different shape from the whole." That's that kind of judgment that kids like. The ending, the eulogy, needs to fit the life we've led. We don't fool people, and the people we don't fool will probably write our endings. Think about that. This is one reason I wish more people attended memorial services, to hear this kind of truth coming out. It can give you a lot of faith in the deep values of life that we need faith in. Sometimes preachers can be pressured not to tell the truth. I remember being at two such memorial services in the last 20 years, and they're both vivid in my memory. And they're vivid because as the preacher went on in a eulogy that was lying, you heard the buzzing start around the room. I was sitting in the back at both of these services, and I eavesdropped everywhere I could, and you hear people telling the story the way it should have been told. They knew how the story should end. They were just wondering whether they were going to hear it from the pulpit that day or whether they'd have to tell it themselves. The most inspiring, I think, and faith-building thing you find at memorial services is that the truth almost always comes out. Sometimes it comes out in the communal eulogies, the open microphone times, when people can tell their own story. I've never yet, I don't think, been at a memorial service when I didn't learn something I hadn't known about this person from these stories, and when the family didn't learn something they hadn't known about these person from the stories. Sometimes quite surprising. The most brutally honest eulogy I know of, this is one of these that you hear and you think, "God, I wish I'd been there to hear that one." It was given by a grand old preacher that I knew in Michigan. He's 91 now and still going fairly strong. It was a memorial service for a member of his church who had been quite wealthy and powerful, but who had used and abused others his entire life. The preacher met with the family and told them what he was going to say if he conducted the service, so they could decide whether they wanted him to conduct the service. And they agreed with his assessment. And so a few days later at the service, the preacher's eulogy began with the words, "Michael was an evil man." Don't you wish you'd been there to hear that? And before he steered the eulogy back to talk about the kinds of values we need to be serving with life, he went into some detail about the life of the man, Michael, who had died. And all over the congregation, heads were nodding. They knew the truth. They knew how the man's story should be told. They just wanted to know if they were going to hear it from the pulpit that day. And I think we know when the ending is right. We know what we want to accept and what we're willing to accept as an ending that fits with the life Now, you can either see this as a kind of tyranny or as a kind of assurance that finally there will be some kind of justice done in life. But you don't have to go to churches to hear this sermon. You can hear this sermon anywhere that we are telling powerful stories that we love. And to prove it to you, I've gone to two of the new movies that came out in the last 2 weeks, and then to a 19th century play that I've loved since I first read it. The first movie I saw was the conclusion of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which was very long, but still pretty spectacular. The Lord of the Rings is a morality tale about the eternal war between greedy power and the weaker, more subtle, disadvantaged force of character and courage. And it ended, as we like all of our favorite stories and myths to end, by saying that in the end, power should bow before truth, character, and courage. And that sometimes, if our character and our courage are strong enough, it will. The Lord of the Rings could be seen as asking the question, who is finally the more strong and noble? Who do we respect and wish to be like? Evil forces with big armies, or a lot of common people with character and courage? And the heroes of the story, as you know if you've read it or seen it, are the commonest of the common people, hobbits. The other movie, which I just saw Friday night, is Mona Lisa Smile, a movie that has had some surprisingly bad reviews, and I'm not sure why. It has some wonderful casting and wonderful ensemble acting that you don't get to see very often. Again, it's a conflict between a nasty kind of power and the quiet persistence of character and courage. The questions of this movie are, what is the difference between high-class people and low-class people with money? And it's also a variation on Jesus' old question, though it's never stated in the movie. What does it profit you if you gain the whole world and you lose your soul? These are very religious movies, both of them. Don't kid yourself. And in the end, the Trump suits, those we feel win, are truth, character, and courage. But we knew at each step in the movie how we would be writing the eulogy for all these characters if their life stopped then. We are always summing up. We are always judging, at least others, if not ourselves, even if we know we are pure and blameless. We know for a fact that those others around us could learn a lot from us. I don't think we fool many people. And for me, this is one of the most inspiring truths in life, that we can't fool many people. That there's something in us that knows the difference. I'm reminded of some lines from a great theologian of 200 years ago, a German named Friedrich Schleiermacher, who's known as the father of liberal theology. And he also believed that we knew what was required of us, that we knew the difference between noble and ignoble paths, and that we didn't fool others, even if we had succeeded in fooling ourselves. He said that we recognize those people who seek for the most true, courageous, and authentic life. We pick them out in our lives, and we admire them more than all others who don't have aims as high. I think he's right. That's another way of saying that we also judge those who aim lower, and that when we write their eulogies in our minds, we compose them in a minor key. Movies like Lord of the Rings trilogy and Mona Lisa's smile, I think, have the effect they do and strike the chords they do, I think, partly for the same reasons that the book The Da Vinci Code has had such a striking effect. Partly it's because they're just good movies. They're stories well told. But also it's because we recognize these stories. We know these plots. They're dramatizations of stories we find ourselves living among. And if we tell these stories over and over, it's because we need to remind ourselves to the higher values we know we need to be aspiring toward, whether we are or not. And one of our favorite lessons, I think it's in all these stories, is simply that it matters how we live. That our lives are judged. There's something like a judgment day when our ending is written for us, and when that time comes, we don't want to fail. Now, judgment day, that's hard to use in a church like this. It's hard to use in many churches. It sounds so hokey and so supernatural. It's hard to hear without getting a mental image of some really bad but effective preachers shaking their Bibles in that theatrical way while interpreting their Bibles in ways so low and mean that Jesus, for one, would have hated it. But I'd hate for us to lose the powerful notion of a judgment day just because we're bored to death with the supernaturalism or we've outgrown it. And that's one of the services that great stories and myths and literature and fairy tales give us. They remind us of these lessons that we don't want to hear but can't afford to forget. Now, one of my favorite plays is one probably very few of you have read or even heard of. It's the play Peer Gynt by the Norwegian Henrik Ibsen that he wrote in 1867. I will use almost any excuse to expose people to it, and it's a natural for talking about endings. Ibsen was strongly influenced by the Danish existentialist Søren Kierkegaard, who's probably my favorite religious thinker. And Kierkegaard's mark is all over this play. It's a play I wish more people knew. I think it's one of the most disquieting plays ever written, maybe especially for Americans. I think Ibsen knew the American soul and gave it a life in this play, even though he'd never been here. Now, the play features, among others, Peer Gynt and a bunch of trolls. You've seen Lord of the Rings. Trolls shouldn't be any problem at all. Trolls are the way that Ibsen pictured inauthentic humans. That's what a troll is. It's an inauthentic human. Just as Tolkien portrayed them as orcs, an idea he may well have gotten from Ibsen. The difference between humans and trolls, which Ibsen makes very clear, is that they live by different mottos. Trolls live by the motto, "To thyself be sufficient," while humans, if they're going to become humans, must live by the motto, "To thyself be true." So you don't have to go to church for these. You just have to be awake to the stories we're telling over and over and over again. And Peer Gynt was a human who lived by the motto of trolls. He became wealthy and influential as a shipping magnate. At the end of his life, he must have been 80 or so, he returned home mostly to gloat, mostly to hide behind trees and look for his old classmates from 60 years ago and imagine how much better he'd done than they had. But what awaited Peer Gynt was Kierkegaard's and Ibsen's version of an existentialist judgment day. His ending was written for him by the voices of all that he'd never become. The judgment came in the form of these voices that called to him as he walked through the woods one day. Listen to these words and see if they aren't scarier than mere supernaturalism could ever be. First, there are these little, they call them thread balls. They're like little teeny tumbleweeds that are in the woods. We are the thoughts you should have thought. Feet to run with you should have given us. We should have soared skywards as challenging voices, but here we must tumble like balls of gray yarn. We are songs. You should have sung us. 1,000 times you pinched and suppressed us. In the depths of your heart we have lain and waited. We were never called forth. Now we poison your voice. We are tears. You should have shed us. We might have melted the icicles that pierced your heart. But now the wound is closed over and our power is gone. We are deeds. Why didn't you do us? Doubts that strangle have crippled and bent us. But on Judgment Day, we shall flock to accuse you, and woe to you then. After that scene, which I think is one of the most sobering scenes in all of literature. After that scene, Peer Gynt met an extremely strange character in the play called the Button Maker. I've never understood the Button Maker, and I've read several essays on the Button Maker. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. It comes from some Norwegian myth that I don't know anything about, and but he's a strange character, and he'd come to get Peer and to take him and to put him back into the casting ladle to melt him down and try again to make what the maker had intended in the first place, which was a human being. That's what Peer Gynt never was. He was never true to himself, and so he was never really a human being. And that's not what the maker had in mind, and the maker hates to waste materials, so it's not a big thing. We'll just take him back and melt him down and try again. Now there, written in the fantastic language of trolls and button makers, is a judgment day that awaits us all, I think. This is the same message, though. Think about it. It's the same message we get in stories like The Lord of the Rings or Mona Lisa Smile or 1,000 other wonderful fairy tales and myths and stories and religious teachings. In the end, we don't get to write our ending. It will be written by the others we didn't fool. That's the message of judgment, of justice. Kids, I think, really like that message. Most of us adults start to feel a little uneasy, wishing, if we're honest, for a bit less justice and a bit more mercy. Now, if you'd rather have more mercy, and I would, then let me read you a famous and controversial and very strange parable by the man Jesus. It is a very strange story. You almost never hear it preached on. And see if it doesn't irritate you. The kingdom of God is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them out into the vineyard. When he went out again about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go to the vineyard, and I'll pay you whatever's right." So they went. When he went out again at noon and then at about 3 o'clock, he did the same. At about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around, and he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" And they said, "Because no one has hired us." So he said, "You also go to the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received a full day's pay. So did those who started at 3, and who started at noon, and who started at 9. So when those hired about early in the morning, they thought they would receive more, but they didn't. Everybody got the same full day's pay. But isn't that irritating? You can't like that. This parable has confused many people. It's been felt to be grotesquely unfair. It is manifestly unfair. But don't look for an economics lesson. This isn't about economics. Don't look for a blueprint for workers' unions. It won't work. This is a spiritual story. So look for a religious lesson and an absolutely profound one. It is saying we can change our life anytime we're ready to do the work. And no matter how late in the game we finally see the light, we use that light, all of it, to light our paths from then on. We get the full pay whenever we're willing to do the work. If you've seen the movie Mona Lisa Smile, one of the characters acted this out just wonderfully. It was the character of Betty, played by an actress that I don't think I've ever seen before, but someone after the first service, who sees more movies than I do, scolded me for not knowing, I still forget her name, and told me that, my God, she'd played the female lead in Spider-Man. So if you've seen Spider-Man, it's her. Kirsten Dunst. See, someone can't stand it not having the name on. It's Kirsten Dunst, and don't forget it. I think she's one of two actresses in this movie that ought to be nominated for a Best Supporting Actress Oscar. And I don't remember the other one's name either. No. It's some woman with a long last name, like Gwendolyn or something. Wonderful. I can see some people have seen this movie. You see this? You can talk about Jesus and no one cares. But you're not messing around with blockbuster movies. Well, the character of Betty plays this role and does it wonderfully, I think. She was in the movie a formidable antagonist. She was brilliant and aggressive. She played the role which had been assigned to her, though, without ever looking at the role to see whether it was worth playing. And that's what this movie is about. It was a God she served without ever wondering whether it was worthy of her and worth serving with a life. It was a role designed to be sufficient to her, but not true to her. And so, this beautiful young woman became a troll. She married, she played the phony role to the hilt, irritating absolutely everyone around her, including her husband, who began straying as soon as he got the chance. When she finally saw the light, when she finally came to work in the vineyard of her own soul, that powerful, wonderful character of hers shifted its center. And at the end, she started as resolutely down a new and hopefully more authentic path as she had been going down a shallow and unworthy one before. Now, in religious language, she was saved. She was born again. That's what it means. Born of the Spirit. It's just what it means. It took her a while to go from troll to human. But when she saw the light, the whole light was still available to guide her path from then on. She got a full day's pay, no matter when she showed up, finally willing to do the work. And she had the merciful chance to rewrite her life before the ending was written. And if you saw the movie, you know before the scene at the end when she changed, you know what a rotten eulogy you would have written for her. It was horrible. Thinking about endings has given me a new and a surprising respect for the profound mercy in this old parable of Jesus's, that all the way up to the end, there's time to change. And you get the full day's pay in the game of the Spirit whenever you're willing finally to show up and to do the work. Once we've lived our life out, whether as a human or a troll, the ending's out of our hands. Then it'll be written by those we never fooled as well as we thought we did. There's the kind of justice that kids think they want. They're young, they have time for that kind of justice. But adults want mercy. So in the meantime, we've reached the end of another year. It's time to review, to see whether we have been true to our best selves or merely sufficient, selling out higher ideals for lower ones or vice versa. Look at the work of fashioning a life, the work of taking ourselves and our lives seriously as though it were working in a vineyard. The pay, the only pay there can be, the only pay there ever is the reward of an authentic life that can walk through the woods late in our days without needing to fear those voices, without needing to fear them at all. We may be early in life, in the middle of it, or living our last chapters, it doesn't matter. Whenever we see the light of a more authentic life, it is there to light our path from then on. We get the full day's pay whenever we finally show up to do the work. Endings are tricky because our ending will be written by those we didn't fool. That's judgment and that's justice. But while we're alive, while we're awake and attentive, if we are attentive to the calls of character and courage and truth, we can make changes in our story, in our life, that can make all the difference in the days and the years ahead. I think Montaigne was correct. If we will just live the life right, the ending will take care of itself. And for an end of the year message, that's about as good as true mercy gets.